You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we have our professor, Professor Alan Blackman. Alan, what have you got for us today?
Hey, Alex, how's things?
Good, good, good.
Good, good. Okay, we're going to kick off talking about superconductivity, which is very interesting stuff, I reckon. And so let's talk about how we transmit electricity. We transmit electricity down wires, and most of it up here comes from down south and comes across the Cook Strait cable, et cetera, et cetera. And on its travels from down south to up here, we lose around about 8% of it just simply through losses due to heat from transmission. Okay, so you can imagine that if we could save 8% of electricity, that would amount to quite a lot and would certainly be economically viable to do so.
Yeah, and that's a high percentage.
It is, it is. And so we use copper wires generally to transmit electricity, and copper wires unavoidably have a resistance to flow of electricity, and this is why we lose 8%, because, as I say, the copper wire heats up due to the fact that it has resistance. In a perfect world, we would use silver wires, but we can probably understand why we wouldn't be doing that. Yeah. Now, so ideally what we want is some sort of wire that can conduct electricity with absolutely no resistance, and then we wouldn't lose any of that energy as it is moved. So it's long been known, in fact since 1911, that these things called superconductors exist. And superconductors are materials, not necessarily very weird ones, that can conduct electricity without any resistance at all. And so that means that we don't lose any energy. And in 1911, it was discovered that mercury, of all things, if you cool that down to a temperature of 4.2 Kelvin, which is okay, which is negative 269 degrees Celsius, yeah, pretty cold, then it becomes what we call a superconductor. And you might ask, well, why 4.2 Kelvin? That just happens to be the boiling point of liquid helium. So you can cool helium down. It's a gas normally. If you cool it down to negative 269 degrees Celsius, it becomes a liquid. And in 1908, they first managed to be able to do that, to get those very, very cold temperatures of 4.2 Kelvin. So they were studying the behavior of materials at very, very low temperatures. They found that mercury was a superconductor at liquid helium temperature. And, you know, that was pretty cool. So that set off a lot of research as to how these things did this. And you know, could we find materials that would superconduct at a higher temperature? And so way back in 1986... they got it all the way up to 35 Kelvin, okay? From 4.2 Kelvin to 35 Kelvin, and that actually won the people a Nobel Prize, because that was a massive, massive improvement in the temperature at which superconductivity came on. And unfortunately, they awarded that probably just a year too soon, because the next year they got it up to 93 Kelvin, okay, which is massive. And so massive, in fact, that was a really, really important advance that was made, because that is hotter than the boiling point of liquid nitrogen, okay? Ooh. Now, liquid helium is exotic. It takes a lot of energy to cool it down to that far. Liquid nitrogen, 80% of the air. Yeah, 80% of the air around us is nitrogen. So if you can cool it down to 76, so that boils at 77 Kelvin. So, or negative 196 degrees Celsius. And so therefore, if you've got something that superconducts at 93 Kelvin, you can cool it down with just liquid nitrogen rather than having to go the whole liquid helium thing. So that's a massive, massive advance. And now, one of the researchers who was actually on that paper way back in 1987 or so, his research group at in Texas has now prepared a material that superconducts up to 151 Kelvin. So this is the new world record now, negative 122 degrees Celsius. So that is, dare I say it, pretty cool. No pun intended.
Still definitely not warm.
Still definitely not warm. But, again, it's a massive advance as to what it used to be, okay? So the material that they used to do this contains mercury, barium, calcium, copper, and oxygen. And so they use quite a neat trick to do this, because what has been known for a long time is that if you exert big pressures on materials, that induces superconductivity. So superconductivity is helped at very, very, very high pressures, okay? And ordinarily what you have to do is you have to keep your material under very, very high pressure for it to exhibit superconductivity. But what they found with this material was if they pressurize it to between 10 and 30 gigapascals, which is probably not a number that really means a heck of a lot to anybody really, unless you're really into pressure, but that's around about 200,000 atmospheres, let's say. So the Earth exhibits one atmosphere and so that's, you know, that's quite high pressure. And what they did was that they exerted very, very high pressure at very low temperature. So they went down to liquid helium temperature, exert this really, really, really high pressure on it. And then what they found was that when you released the pressure, that the superconductivity was somehow sort of locked in this material. So therefore they could warm it up, and they could warm it up all the way up to 151 Kelvin without it losing its sort of locked in superconductivity. So this is kind of a new way of doing this. And, you know, people are probably thinking, okay, so what? This just sounds like an academic bloody, you know, whatever, whoop-de-doo. But the holy grail with all of this is, as hopefully you can imagine, room temperature superconductivity. Now, that has already been done, but only under ridiculously high pressure situations and with tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of material. So it's totally impractical at the moment. But if we keep making these big advances in these materials and getting closer and closer and closer to room temperature at atmospheric pressure, that's the important thing. So if we can get materials that can superconduct at room temperature at atmospheric pressure, whoever does that first, by golly, they're going to be rich. They are going to be rich. You're going to be instant Nobel Prize, absolutely. No doubt about that. And they're just going to be extraordinarily rich, because so many applications of superconductivity that we've got now, and they do require these low temperatures. So for instance, if ever you've had an MRI scan, the magnet in that has to be cooled down to 4.2 Kelvin in order for that to work. And you then get a superconducting magnet that goes on forever and ever and ever and ever, amen, doesn't need any energy input so long as you keep it at 4.2 Kelvin. But if we could be doing that at room temperature, oh, you know, it'd be just such a game changer for humanity. It would just change everything. So this is, again, this is an advance. I think they've increased the record by about 10 Kelvin, there or thereabouts. So on and on they go. And, you know, we will continue to make advances. And eventually, I'm pretty sure that, you know, they will come up with a room temperature superconductor. Yeah.
Awesome.
So that's exciting stuff. Yeah.
So much electricity move. Like, I don't know. Like, it's one of those things where it's just like, yeah, turns out we've got a lot of cables. We've got a lot of power going places.
And indeed, New Zealand's sort of at the forefront of this. So a group down at Victoria University have been sort of instrumental in making sort of what we call high temperature superconductors. And by high temperature, you mean anything greater than 77 Kelvin. But it's not enough to just have the material that's going to superconduct. You've also got to be able to fashion it into a wire. And so that's another problem that has to be overcome. You know, if it's a ceramic thing, then it won't have any give in it, so it'll just snap. So it's got to be, you know, it's got to have the properties of these wires that we use now. So, you know, there's another problem as well. But, you know, let's crack the first problem first.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. Hexagons. What have you got for us?
Diamonds. So, hexagonal diamond apparently is a thing. Who would have thunk that? So, why are we interested in diamonds? We're interested in diamond because diamonds are the hardest known substance.
Yes.
Which is kind of cool. And the reason that they are the hardest known substance is all down to the way that the carbon atoms in diamond are arranged. Okay, so every carbon atom in diamond is surrounded by four other carbon atoms, and so on and so on and so on, all the way to infinity in three dimensions. And that particular arrangement we call a cubic arrangement of carbon, okay? So we get what we call a lattice, which you can make cubes out of and then extend those cubes infinitely in three dimensions to make the bulk structure of what we call diamond, okay, cubic diamond. Now, way back in 1962, somebody put on their thinking caps and thought, if we take that cubic lattice and just move one layer of carbon atoms relative to the other to make what we call as a hexagonal lattice, so a sort of a six-fold lattice rather than a cubic lattice, then we reckon that that should in fact be even harder than diamond. And so this was a theoretical study to begin with. And this was supposed to have been realized about 5 years later in 1967, where they had a material called Lonsdaleite. So the people who came up with this idea said that, okay, in order to get this hexagonal carbon, you're probably going to have very high temperatures, very high pressures. People thought, where do we get very high pressures, very high temperatures? Aha, meteorites. Okay, so, you know, they're coming in, bam, 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 bam. So they get very hot in the atmosphere. They hit the Earth, lots of high pressure. And, surprise, surprise, so they supposedly found this Lonsdaleite, this hexagonal carbon in a meteorite in 1967. And ever since then, it's sort of been a source of controversy because the data have been equivocal, let's say. And, you know, people are thinking, oh, it's not this pure hexagonal diamond. It's probably a mixture of cubic diamond and hexagonal diamond. And they've never been able to isolate a decent amount of a pure sample of this. So we jump to the present day and we go to a bunch of Chinese workers who have just published a paper in Nature. And this now appears to be a pure sample of this hexagonal diamond, and they've made it now in quantities, and they're talking about a little bit about sort of 1 millimeter by 1 meter, so you know we're talking big quantities for a chemist there, but in quantities that then allow its hardness to be determined. Okay,
and so we can test it now.
Indeed. And so what they have found is that this does appear to be harder than diamond. And how do they make this? Well, again, with the first story, we're talking about high pressures, very, very high pressures. Surprise, surprise, the same sort of thing happens here. So in order to make this hexagonal diamond, they start with very, very, very pure graphite. And graphite is the lead in your pencil, basically. That's a form of carbon. It's what we call an allotrope of carbon. It's one way of arranging the carbon atoms. So instead of three-dimensional, graphite is two-dimensional, okay? And funnily enough, it's got hexagonal rings in it. So it looks like chicken wire, basically. So graphite looks like chicken wire, and it comes in layers and layers and layers and layers of chicken wire. And they take that and they subject it to, again, 20 gigapascals, about 200,000 times the pressure of the Earth's atmosphere, and they heat it up to between 1,300 and 1,900 degrees Celsius. Okay. They find that if they go any hotter than that, they end up with just good old cubic diamond, but they seem to have figured out that if they maintain it between those temperatures, after having 20 gigapascals on it for 10 hours, that it seems to give this hexagonal diamond, this new form of diamond, which is kind of cool. So let's see where we go with this, because obviously, you know, diamond, is, apart from its aesthetic qualities...
Of course.
Obviously, you know, things like diamond tip saws and stuff like that. Anything where we need, you know, something very, very sharp or very, very abrasive, diamond is extremely useful in that. So if we can make an even harder form of diamond, you know, you can see obviously the advantages of that. So, as I say, let's see how this pans out and whether they can start making really bulk quantities of this and see how useful it really is. So, yeah.
Gotta love hexagons.
Absolutely.
Strong shape. And finally, we have, I mean, in celebration of a few days ago now, Pi Day.
Pi Day.
Pi. What do you got for us about Pi?
Well, Pi Day. Okay, so Saturday, in fact, was Pi Day. And the reason that they call it Pi Day is because it is the 14th day of the third month, okay? And, of course, in America, they go the other way around when they talk about dates. So they go the third month, the 14th day, 3-1-4. Okay, which are the first three digits of pi. So that's why they call it Pi Day in the States, the 14th of March. Now, obviously, if you're in New Zealand, then that would be 31st of the 4th, wouldn't it? Okay. Now, the 31st of April doesn't exist. So Pi Day doesn't actually exist in New Zealand. But so this gives us an excuse to talk about Pi. Pi is just amazing. It's been known for literally thousands of years, and it is quite simply the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. And so its value to a few decimal places, 3.14159265536, that's what I can remember it to anyway. Most people remember it to just sort of 3.14. Now, it's got lots of special qualities. So number one, it's what we call an irrational number, which means it can't be written as a fraction. It can't be written of a fraction of two integers. So you'll see numbers like 22 upon 7, for example, as being approximately pi. So that comes out to 3.143. Or 355 over 113, and that comes out to 3.1416, which is, getting better and better and better. But you'll still never get an exact value of pi by taking the fraction of two integers. You can't do it. We've known its value, as I say, literally for thousands of years. So Archimedes, way back in about 250 BC, okay, or BCE, should I say, he got the lower and the upper bounds of pi as 3.1408 to 3.1429, and the actual value of pi does exist between those. And now we know it literally to trillions of digits, and that is all thanks to advances in mathematics and things called infinite series, and we're not going to get into that at all. As recently as 1949, the world record for knowing pi was 2,037 digits, and they did this on the best computer of the day in the world, and it's called the ENIAC machine, and that took 70 hours of computation to get it to 2,037 digits, okay? And we sort of think of the things that we can do today in, milliseconds on a desktop computer, why are we interested in pi? Well, pretty much everything in math depends on pi. Anything trigonometric, so sines, cosines, all of that sort of stuff, they're all going to have pi in them. Anything involving circles is going to be have some dependence on pi. And way back in 1897, the state legislature of Indiana in the USA, they nearly passed a bill that would have made pi equal to 3.2, which
feels wrong.
Which would have meant that Indiana circles would have been different from the circles in the rest of the planet. And this was all due to some pseudo-mathematician who thought that it would just make life easier if you just had pi as being a rational number and blah, blah, blah. So just sort of defying common logic. And luckily, apparently the lower house or whatever passed it, and then luckily it came within the hearing of a mathematician who just thought, oh my God, we can't have this, and so they sort of advised, and they didn't vote against it, but it never got sort of continued on, apparently. But so here's my question. So if pi is irrational, okay, and it goes on for literally trillions and trillions and trillions of digits, it never stops, then we can't know the exact circumference of a circle.
Ooh,
because
there's always
going to be some uncertainty. We don't know the exact circumference of a circle. So my answer to that, here's my quandary here. The easy thing to do is just take your circle and cut it, and then you get a straight line. Okay? Which has got that same length as the circumference of that circle. So surely we can just measure the length of that, and then we get the exact value. But we can't have the exact value in a circle. Where's my logical flaw in this? There we go. There we go, listeners.
Math.
There we go.
Math.
Have a think.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Brain bender. So good old brain bender.
That'll keep you up at night like it does me. So there we go. So that's Pi Day. The next one we're going for is Mole Day, which is 10/23, or the 23rd of October in the USA. Okay. So
awesome.
There we go.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, MOTAT, and thank you, Science. STEMVIR is back again at MOTAT. Enjoy hands-on activities and demonstrations next weekend,
cool,
the 28th to the 29th of March.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.